mashed potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films ISS, Founders Day, Origin, and The Righteous Gemstones and Wellington Paranormal. But there's also going to be some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Doctor Who, the Third Doctor era. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's hit the box office really quickly because, I mean, it's kind of interesting being the second week of the year and there being a decent hit. And this is a new movie, not something that's spilled over from award season, and that was Mean Girls, which made over $28 million for the weekend and over $30 million, I think $32 million for the four-day. And that was impressive, mainly because Mean Girls was originally supposed to go just to Paramount Plus. When they were developing it, Paramount said, oh, this is actually getting some good traction. It's getting a lot of fans getting interest in it. So maybe it's worth putting it into theaters. And they did the same thing with the film Smile. If you remember, I think it was in 2022, it was a horror movie, a really great little horror movie called Smile, because there's so many people that say we need to have more theatrical releases. But that's not always the case. There are some movies that go to theaters that aren't going to be a hit and they end up getting lost. And there's also this misconception that a studio doesn't make any money by putting something on a streaming service. This is how it worked during cable. It used to be that if they were going to do well in theaters, they got a theatrical run. But usually movies that weren't strong enough to make it in theaters, they either got sold off to HBO or Showtime or one of those as an original movie, or sometimes they ended up on stuff like TBS. So the idea of an at-home original movie is nothing new. It's just diversified a little bit. And for the most part, when I hear that happening, that seems to be with movies that are horror-related. Because horror movies tend to be a bit of a cash cow, and they still are because they're relatively inexpensive to make. Whereas Mean Girls took a heftier budget because it was a big musical and production number. But the small little cheap horror movies, those you can easily pivot into theaters and then make some money. But it doesn't mean that putting something directly on your streaming service is a loss. Like the same thing happened with Good Burger 2, which hit Paramount Plus a couple weeks ago. That one was never meant for theaters, and if it wasn't going to make money, why did they make it? No, it helps to boost subscription levels and that sort of thing. Also, now that so many streaming services are pivoting towards an advertising platform, that's where they're going to be making money. And also, here's something. Not a whole lot of people have pointed this out. I've heard some people point this out, but this is the reality. It is more valuable. You are more valuable to the studios as somebody who's going to watch ads than to be somebody who goes to a premium level. Like, for example, Prime Video at the beginning of February, I believe, is moving towards an ad tier model as their default. Now, you can pay, and it's something like $3 a month more. I'm going to pay that. That's $36 a year. That's seriously not a whole lot of money when you look at the grand scheme of things. And I would rather not have ads on Prime because I watch so much stuff on Prime. I also get BritBox, which feeds into Prime, and I don't need it adding more ads to that. So I can watch my Prime movies without ads, mainly because it just depends on what you're watching and how clean you want it. And for me, I watch so many movies on Prime that I would much rather not have ads. Whereas, you know, if it's a TV series or an episode, you're kind of used to that. That's the default, is to have ads and something like that. But anyways, Mean Girls did quite well for it being something that was originally going to go to Prime, but it did get a lower cinema score. And it was like a B because a lot of people didn't know it was a musical. They actually made a point not to market it as a musical because musicals mean something different. I don't know. It's a marketing speak. And I think you could have showed that it was a musical. And so, even though I kind of guessed it was a musical, but that's because I watch trailers differently than people. In the number two spot at the box office, you had The Beekeeper, which made just over $16 million, over $18 million for the four-day holiday weekend with Martin Luther King's Day. And that actually was better than people expected. People were not expecting it to do that well. And look, $16 million over a three-day weekend isn't like breaking any records. But that's not a bad show for a Jason Statham movie coming out in January. So, you know, that worked. Then it was like Wonka and Anyone But You and Migration. Aquaman's out of the top five. The Book of Clarence completely cratered and flopped into ninth place with $2.5 million. It just barely cracked $3 million for the four-day Martin Luther King Day weekend. So that one was not a success. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to talk about is one I've been wanting to play this for a while. It comes out next month, but I've been curious about this, and I finally sat down and watched it, and that is Lisa Frankenstein, which comes to theaters on February 9th.
Are you hot for anyone? He doesn't play sports. I tend to his grave. I talk to him. I wish I was with you. Your hand? I can't believe you're here. Do you like music? I have the cure. Oh, not that kind of cure. They can't make you better. I mean, they can, but like emotionally.
The biggest thing I knew about this, it was written by Diablo Cody. And I'm like, Diablo Cody? Is she still around? If you recall, Diablo Cody came on very, very strong, and she did a series called, I think it was called The United States of Terra, and she's best known for writing Juno, which is a great movie, and she got overexposed super fast, and she has a very particular way of writing that can irritate you if you're just not clicking with her style. It's going to be a pain in the keister. So last movie I remember her having a high-profile involvement in was Jennifer's Body, which was a flop, and that's because Megan Fox can't act her way out of a wet paper bag. Lisa Frankenstein, it's playing with convention, it's playing with hipness, but the thing is, it's not 2007 anymore. I mean, we're almost 20 years away from Juno. So trying the same kind of punchy dialogue may not click. And also part of what made Juno, I think, work with that punchy, cool little dialogue is Juno otherwise was a very drab kind of humdrum, average sort of everyday life type movie. And it was the dialogue that added brightness to it with these interesting characters. It could have been a very dull, boring, depressing story. But the writing kind of made it pop. This thing looks like the whole movie's this bubblegum pop 80s throwback style. And I don't know if that's going to clash with her writing. But who knows? We'll see. This could be fun, but I'm not keeping my fingers crossed for it. The next trailer I want to talk about is for Spaceman, which comes to Netflix on March 1st.
6 months in isolation. You stop thinking too much.
I'm getting an appearance.
I did not intend to frighten you, skinny human. Do not be afraid.
I'm losing my mind.
You wish to know if I am real. I am like you, an explorer. Your loneliness intrigued me.
This is Adam Sandler in a dramatic role. He plays an astronaut who's been in space for months, and his wife, Carrie Mulligan, is back on Earth and she's pregnant. And he meets an entity in space that takes the form of a giant spider. You can't hear it, and it's not like the voice you'd get for a giant spider. This is not the giant spider from the Hobbit movies. It seems a little more benevolent, but there might be something other than that in this thing. First, I thought it was going to be a comedy because, you know, Adam Sandler's involved. But no, this is a dramatic side for him. And it just looks very weird. And I'm looking forward to that. But always, when it comes to these dream logic kind of bizarre character studies, it can go either way, depending on how it's put together. But, you know, it's got my attention. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Founders Day and Wellington Paranormal.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
Ground control to Major Tom. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Founder's Day. This is a horror film, and it started out as a very small release, and it expanded. It's done by an independent filmmaker named Eric Boonquist, and I've reviewed his stuff in the past, but we'll talk about that in a second. During a small town's annual fall festival, a masked killer starts targeting civilians.
A town festival with a masked killer running around!
Whoever it is just getting showy.
That's how these guys start to trip up.
I know there's a lot of speculation. I know there's a lot of rumors going around.
What happened that night?
Let's all stay close to home. Don't let your children out. Stay safe.
Many of you have asked why we are moving ahead with today's festivities in light of the recent tragedy.
Don't you dare lecture me about Founder's Day.
One of the biggest, it's not an issue I have with the movie, but it's sort of a regret, is that it wasn't released in the fall. Because it's a horror movie that takes place right before Halloween in the fall, and it has an upcoming election. It was primed to be dropped right before Halloween. But I understand why they didn't do it. I mean, you're dealing with Five Nights at Freddy's as a big competitor, and then you had Thanksgiving coming up like a month later. So I could see people putting this film out there saying this would maybe not be the best time. One of the nice things about horror movies is horror movies tend to work in almost any market. There are horror movies that do well in the fall. There's horror movies that do well in the winter. Actually, the one time that horror movies don't really click is in the summer, because sometimes they get overshadowed. That doesn't mean that some don't work well as summertime releases. I mean, I think some of The Conjuring were summertime movies. I mean, just because it's summer doesn't mean people aren't going to want to watch a horror movie. August, January, October, you know, even like April, those are good times to release a horror movie. And so I understand why they move this into the January frame, even though it all takes place in the fall. But this is, ultimately, it's a homage to 80s slasher movies, and it's done very well. And you can totally tell the people involved in this movie love 80s slasher movies. I love 80s slasher movies. And for as much as everybody's, oh, remember the 80s slasher movies? You have no idea how many slasher movies there were in the 80s. I'm a fan. And every now and then there's ones that pop up and I'm like, God, I didn't even know that existed. They were making like new ones every couple months. It was just everybody was jumping on the bandwagon, because anybody who could scrape together like $1 million could put together a slasher movie and make 10. And they didn't have to be huge money makers. They just had to make their budget back. And that's ultimately also what, even though this isn't associated with Blumhouse, that is the Blumhouse model of saying, do it cheap and make the money back. So these smaller movies tend to do well in these off months. The bigger movies, horror movies, can do well in the summer. But ultimately, you end up with a time frame that it doesn't matter what's going on in the movie. You can release it at different times of the year. And when it comes to this film, I mean, like I said, it sets it up exactly as a slasher movie would. And that's what happened with Thanksgiving back in November. And look, as a fan, that's who it's made for. It's made for the fans of the genre. If you're somebody who doesn't like slasher movies, don't say you're not going to like this movie. Seriously, you're not. I mean, it covers all the bases. And it takes place in a contemporary setting. I mean, it's a modern movie, but it is definitely a slasher movie for the fans. It has all the tropes. You know, it has the different teenage archetypes, and the difference between this movie and a lot of other homage movies to slashers is it does some clever little things. You know, it has some interesting twists and turns. It changes the plot around a little bit. And, I mean, on one hand, it follows the formula. And, you know, doing a homage is different than doing a satire. And this is a homage. I mean, it has the you know, the overbearing parents, and it has the rebel teenager, and it has the geeks, and it has the sex mad group, and you know, so it has all the different characters you'd expect, but they're not necessarily goofing on it. It's not a satire. It's not a comedy. You may think it's funny. I thought some things were very funny, because being such a horror movie fan, you know, I bring that with me. But it takes some turns. It knows the genre enough that it can break convention. And then at that level, it suddenly becomes its own movie. And that's actually really clever. And like I said, this guy who directed it, Eric Bloomquist, he's done a couple other movies, and I've reviewed them. There was one like She Can't Go in the Woods, and there was, 10 to Midnight, something like that. It took place on a radio station with Caroline Williams. And his stuff, I thought his stuff was okay. This one I thought was actually probably his best movie that I've seen. And what's funny, he's in it. plays like a political advisor with who looks honestly weirdly like Chris Hayes from MSNBC. But he actually gives himself a role in the movie, but it's a minor role. He's not like the main guy or anything like that. He just kind of gets himself inserted into the film. But he's having fun with it, but without chewing the scenery or without winking and nodding at the audience. I think that this actually manages to start off as a movie that's paying homage to slashers, but then kind of becomes its own thing and kind of becomes its own movie and adds something different to the genre. So I think that that's really what makes this movie work really well done. I mean, it's a nice homage to 80 slasher films with some clever surprises. I'm going to say that Founders Day totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next thing I want to talk about is Wellington Paranormal. A small New Zealand police department faces off against the paranormal to try to keep the peace.
Kia ora, Aotearoa. I'm Sergeant Marker of the Wellington Police. Over the last few years, there's been a rise in the number of incidents that cannot be classified as normal. They have to be considered paranormal. I made them their own special folder. It's quite thick, see? In order to deal with these cases, I have assembled Officers Minogue and O'Leary.
Minogue, I'm just requesting assistance here.
Caught on a fence again, O'Leary.
Yep.
Be sure to watch Wellington Paranormal, a new documentary series, and see why Minogue, O'Leary, and I are your last line of defense.
This is a series on HBO, you can find it on Max. This is a spinoff of the original movie, What We Do in the Shadows. Now, I know that Hulu has the series, What We Do in the Shadows, about a bunch of vampires living in Staten Island. That is not actually a remake, but it's a spinoff of the original movie, What We Do in the Shadows, which was a New Zealand production. And there's a scene in What We Do in the Shadows where these police officers come over to investigate strange happenings at the house. And being vampires, you're able to hypnotize them. So they have these two officers kind of going through the house, and they're not noticing anything. I mean, they got dead bodies and people hanging from ceilings and all that kind of stuff, but they just think it's totally normal because they've been hypnotized. And these two officers, they're very dry humor. One's a very no-nonsense woman, and then the other one's kind of this dopey, tall, lanky guy. They were so popular in that movie that they decided to make an entire series out of them, and then they have to go investigate all these different paranormal events. I ended up swerving into it on Max. Oh, gosh, it was been a while ago that I started watching it because, you know, there are four seasons. It's a New Zealand show, so, you know, that, like the British shows, they tend to be less than 10 episodes a season. But I would watch it periodically. I have my movies and shows that I watch late on a Saturday night after I've had a couple cocktails. And this was one of them over the years. And this is a wickedly funny show. I love the mockumentary style. It's been overused since The Office became popular. And the key with mockumentaries, you need to be realistic. You need to treat it as if it really is a documentary. And that's what makes this work. Also, the delivery of the two officers are just, they're very dry and very no nonsense, even when wild and crazy things are happening. And you know, it's had four seasons, but the fact that they were able to keep it fresh during this whole time was quite amazing to me. So, I mean, the dry wit gives this mockumentary plenty of laughs. I mean, it's a lot of fun. Wellington Paranormal totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the films ISS and Origin.
You're dead, you're dead, you're dead, you're dead and out of this world.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews and talk about ISS. The big name behind this movie is Ariana DeBose, and it's not a musical. So, I mean, yeah, she won an Academy Award, but she's still building her career. And I commend her for that. So anyways, let's talk about ISS. The crew of the International Space Station are at odds when a war starts on Earth, and they are ordered to secure the station for their own respective governments.
Hey, guys.
Wait a minute, what the hell is going on down there?
Oh, whoa.
We gotta get out now, guys.
Let's get out.
Oh, my God.
War has broken out below. And we were told to take the ISS by any means necessary.
If we got orders from our government to take control,
First of all, I have to admit, this is one of my favorite genres. There are these subgenres that I've always enjoyed in science fiction and horror. You know, one of them being people stuck on a space station and having to deal with stuff. Aliens, a great example of that. You know, something like, there was a movie called Life a couple years ago with Jake Gyllenhaal and Ryan Reynolds and the Cloverfield Paradox that took place on this. For some reason, I love those kind of movies. I find them very intriguing because they look cool and they're sort of visionary, but they also have a feel of a bottle episode of a TV show. But they're usually have some clever writing in them and some interesting ideas. So I love things that take place on a space station. Another one of my favorite genres, and I've talked about this before, sort of subgenres, is when somebody is in a lab setting and they're trying to do something that will save the world and help humanity, and it goes horribly awry. I mean, it could be everything from that movie Splice that I talked about several months ago. Could be even something like Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which feels like that. So like the laboratory setting that unleashes something horrible. I love those movies. For some reason, that just kind of gets me. Those are kind of like some of my favorite subgenres. So this ISS movie certainly falls into that. And it has a good setup. The effects are generally good in the background. The stuff that's always difficult in a movie like this, unless you're going to go rent the vomit comet like they did for Apollo 13, the weightless stuff always looks bad. You can always tell, you can see where they paint out the lines and the straps, but you can still see where the stirrup is. They don't float naturally, and you got to shoot that in the right way. And so they didn't shoot it perfectly, so it looked really goofy at times. And also, you shouldn't move that much in space. They look like they're being jostled around. Whereas, if you're in a space station and you're in a secure orbit, it's not going to feel like you're being bounced around. It's you're not going to be wobbling. And so it gets a little wobbly at times. So those are just some sort of like setup and cinematography elements I didn't like. I thought it was a really neat idea because this, at least realistically, is how it could happen, where you get a single message out and then you have scientists who are not necessarily military people who are then told, secure the station, and your whole dynamic has to change. And you don't know what each person is bringing with them to the table. So you could find somebody who's very willing to get violent very quickly. The writing's not as strong as it really could be. It paints itself into some corners. The one thing that I do find very irritating about it is it has a commitment to not commit. It doesn't give you any background. It doesn't even tell you what happened on the planet, but you can see through the windows, the country's on fire. You know, it's bright and it's burning, and you can see big flashes of nuclear weapons going off. So you know there's something major. There wasn't just a single terrorist event. It's a full-on war. But they don't give you any information about that, which is, I guess, realistic for the situation that they are, and it plays into it's a single room 250 miles above the surface of the Earth. But it feels empty at that time, and even how things resolve, you're just kind of like, okay, just tell me what happened, you know, and that's annoying because they kind of go out of their way to avoid giving any explanation. And also, especially when you get to the end, as you're winding into the third act, they kind of have to manufacture an appropriate climax with some real corny cliches and tropes that, I mean, I know why they're doing it, but it just, the writing wasn't as much as it could have been. This could have been a really interesting movie. And it is, but it misses several marks. I mean, I still liked it, but, you know, I mean, it's conceptually interesting, but predictable with a plot that paints itself into so many corners. But still, I like the genre, and I think Ariana DeBose does a decent job in the movie, so I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Origin. This is directed by Ava DuVernay, and she came on strong with the movie Selma several years ago. And she's had some rocky roads. She was originally tapped to do Black Panther, but she bowed out. She did A Wrinkle in Time for Disney. And as fascinating and interesting as that movie is, it is really kind of a train wreck. But she has gone back to doing documentaries and stuff. And so this isn't a documentary, it's a narrative feature, but it does exist in this netherworld between the two. This true story follows an author as she develops the thesis that American racism results from the caste system.
Are you interested in writing something for us?
I don't do assignments anymore.
Yeah, well, you're a better writer than most people do anything.
I want to be in the story. Really inside the story. And build a thesis that shows how all of this is linked.
I gotta be honest with you, I don't understand. I don't see it.
Couple things with the movie. First of all, it's 2.5 hours long, or 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it's too long. It's too long. Can we make movies under 2 hours, please? Because this doesn't have a strong internal drive. It tries to do multiple things. On one hand, it tells the true story of this woman developing this thesis, which she published in a book several years ago, and it was a bestseller. So it deals with her researching that and interacting with people and having interviews with people about this. But it also deals with her personal life and her husband, who she loses due to illness, and her mother, who's getting too old and they need to put her in a home. So then it has all this elements of her personal life. So is it a biopic? Is it a development of the story? It gets confusing. It's trying to do multiple things. And at the same time, tell these historical stories of race, everything from two black people or people, I think, of mixed race during the Holocaust, and a Jewish couple, or this guy who falls in love with a Jewish girl at the build-up to the Holocaust, all the way up to the Trayvon Martin shooting. I mean, so it has all these signposts that mark racial history of the world, but it bites off so much of this, and it doesn't completely chew it all, and never gets fully digested, and it feels more like this could have been a documentary series than a narrative feature. But bottom line is, I don't want to sound dismissive on this, because this is important stuff to study, but it's academic stuff. At a certain point, I watch this and I'm like, okay, so it's not racism, it's a caste system, so what? And I don't mean that dismissively. I mean, no, so what? So how does that change things? I mean, yes, you can look at it in an academic setting, but are you going to change anybody's mind? Are you going to affect social change with knowing this, with this knowledge? And I don't think you will. It's sort of like people who define racism and they say there's no such thing as black racism because it needs to be the people in power oppressing. And I'm like, well, if you narrowly define it that way, sure, but there's also a colloquial version of racism, and when you tell somebody black people can't be racist, they're absolutely wrong. From the colloquial definition, anybody can be racist. And that's kind of what I feel like's going on here. So, I mean, this is a socially important film, but it kind of leaves you wondering how the academic awakening can actually lead to meaningful change. It's not pointless. It's just an academic study, much more than any use in practicality. So, between all those problems, I'm going to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Righteous Gemstones and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Doctor Who, the Third Doctor era. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's wrap things up for the show with a look at another HBO series, The Righteous Gemstones. Now, this has been on for 3 seasons. This HBO comedy spotlights a corrupt family in charge of a megachurch as they manage their empire.
Your whole ministry is set up to serve the gemstones.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
Well, I ain't. Praise be to he.
Why does Daddy leave me out of everything?
Being leaders, that's men's business.
I'm more of a man than Kelvin is.
Why can't I argue with you there?
Good afternoon, Jesus. Thank you for letting me be born into this world as a gemstone.
I grew up in a rural area.
What she's trying to say is that she is a poverty person.
This is spearheaded by Danny McBride, Jodie Hill, and David Gordon Green. Now, while I like some of the things that David Gordon Green has done, these kind of comedies I'm not a huge fan of. I mean, they're the ones who did Eastbound and Down, which has some elements of fun to it. But, you know, stuff with them, and I don't know who's the one who brings this to the table. I'm going to say Danny McBride and Jodie Hill, because I've seen stuff by David Gordon Green without them, and it doesn't have this element. And it's an element of mean-spiritedness. And I'm not saying that about them personally. They may be lovely people. I have a feeling Danny McBride is a great friend. But all of the characters he tries to play are unpleasant people. Like mean-spirited people, the kind, and I described this one, like, it was a week or two ago, I described two ways of teasing. You tease somebody so everybody has fun. I do that with my kids. We tease each other all the time about silly things, and it's all in good fun. And then there's teasing that, like, my uncle would do, which wasn't really teasing, it was bullying. His goal was to make somebody cry. If this didn't end in tears, it was a failure. And that's bullying. That is not teasing whatsoever. You can have a roast and everybody have a good spirit about it. You're not going to be like Taylor Swift glaring over a glass saying, oh, you can't make fun of me. No, have a good humor about things. That's why the show's called Fat Guys at the Movies. Anyway, so there's an element of that permeates the Righteous Gemstones. And it's there in spades because this family, they are bad people. They are objectively bad people. And they pander in that prosperity gospel. And I've spoken out at length about what horse crap the prosperity gospel is. For those who don't know what the prosperity gospel is, boiled down, it's that God rewards the righteous. If you're wealthy, that's a good thing. That's God rewarding you, which is 100% out of line with the Bible. There are entire books of the Bible that refute that. But they are conveniently ignored because people like money. And this tends to be what mega churches and televangelists would do. They live in this lap of luxury, and they're like, oh no, this is God smiling upon you. And it's like, talk to Mother Teresa about that. That's sort of the character. And they're all caustic people. And like John Goodman plays the father, and he's sort of the patriarch of the church. And even though he's got some darkness to him, he puts on a good show. He can really turn a crowd. He's a politician as much as he is a preacher. But it is very funny to watch. There are some genuinely hilarious moments, and the characters are so absurd. They're so absurd at times that it makes it a lot of fun to watch. When you have such an awful group of people, when you have such terrible characters, you have to have them running into people that are worse than them. And that's kind of what they do. So that's how they get sympathy on the Gemstone side. But I can't shake that feeling. I can't get rid of my disdain for them. You know, when they started the series, that's kind of was, well, we're just going to look at these awful people in their lives. And, you know, sort of like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Like I said, McBride and Green and Hill all love playing around with just despicable characters. But then eventually they fall in love with the characters and they have trouble giving them some redemption. That was one of the things I remember when Arrested Development first came out. That's a great show, but they're all horrible people. And then if you show some growth, you ruin the characters. No, you don't want them to grow. And so I think one of the things is, as you go through the three seasons, the creators, McBride, Green, and Hill, fall in love with these characters. And the only way to give them sympathy is to have them up against people that are worse than them. And I mean, that works to a degree. The other thing they do is they have their mother was this real charming, lovable woman, and she was the matriarch, and she was great. But she was still a sleazebag because she was all in on this prosperity gospel. She had no problem living in this lap of this audaciousness and didn't see anything wrong with it ethically, morally, or biblically. And so she's just as despicable as them. She's just got a prettier smile. But the character's dead, and so everybody remembers her fondly. So, yeah, I'm real conflicted because I enjoyed the series. It's incredibly well made, and it's very funny. You know, and it's while it's full of colorful and interesting characters, it's just hard to shake their repulsive nature enough to enjoy the Gemstone story. So as much as I did like it, I also feel bad about liking it. So I'm going to give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Doctor Who. I know I've talked about Doctor Who in the past. Obviously, Shutegawa has now become the new Doctor. And so I had a whole big talk about that at the turn of the year. But I want to look in the past because I subscribed to BritBox and they got all the old, or as many of the old Doctor Who episodes as still survive. Because a whole bunch of them were made, especially in the 60s, that they were just on tapes and they got taped over because they weren't thinking that this was going to have a longevity for more than 60 years. But anyways, I've been going back and watching the era of the Third Doctor. And my favorite has always been Tom Baker, who was the Fourth Doctor from the mid-70s into the 80s. And I loved him because I grew up with him. That's what I would watch as a kid, you know, in first and second grade on Sunday mornings. But the guy before him, I'd never really gone back and watched his stuff. So I watched pretty much his whole run. And so Jon Pertwee stars as the famous BBC Time Lord, banished to Earth and left to fight everything from Daleks to dinosaurs.
You really believe in a man who's helped to save the world twice, with the power to transform his physical appearance?
I'm not sure yet. It may not be the same man.
An alien who travels through time and space in a police box?
Death is always more frightening when it strikes invisibly.
Who the heck are you?
I am usually referred to as the Master.
Courage isn't just a matter of not being frightened, you know? It's being afraid, doing what you have to do anyway.
This is our planet.
Well, what's neat is because I grew up with Tom Baker, his place in the Earth universe at the time was established with the Second Doctor and then kind of galvanized with the Third Doctor. He was a scientific advisor for this group called UNIT, which is the United Nations International Task Force or something like that. And they basically studied paranormal phenomenons. And there are a bunch of characters that carry over from the different incarnations of Doctor Who. So the fact that I watched a lot of those characters in the Tom Baker years, I got to see them being developed during the Jon Pertwee years. And that's a lot of fun. I enjoy that. Jon Pertwee had his own way of doing it. You got to remember, he was only the third guy to do the Doctor. And so the first guy was really old. The second guy, John Troughton, was younger. Pertwee was sort of middle-aged. He was probably in his 50s or at least late 40s at the time. And he ends up with gray hair by the end. And he gave a unique spin to him. He kind of brought back that intellectual, that academic side to the Doctor, the stuffy sort of yesteryear character. But he had some just absurd things. Like one of the things, he was an expert on this martial arts from an alien race. And so he'd always just go, hi! And then he'd just, I don't know, he'd fling his arm and the person would flip over. I never quite figured how he did stuff. At one point, he actually does the Vulcan neck pinch. I think he describes it as something else, but I think that had to have been a little tip of the hat to Star Trek. The Jon Pertwee years, that's when they first started doing it in color. So they really beefed up the rubber monsters. I'm not going to say they got the special effects looking better because it was as cheesy as all get out. But they took advantage to the color. Not everything was in great color. Some of it was somewhat drab. But they did have some really cool, colorful scenes. Like even there's an episode with the Daleks where suddenly the Daleks are different colors, which they really hadn't done in the series. They did it for the two Doctor Who movies with Peter Cushing. But that was just because they were shot in Technicolor. But you got to understand, the first and the second Doctor was all black and white. It was not dynamic to look at, and they really increased that. So by the time they got to the fourth Doctor, it had a certain look. And as cheesy as it is now, it's still a lot of fun. So, I mean, the fourth Doctor is still my favorite. But Pertwee's range is chock full of charm and taking some wild chances for the early 70s. They ground a lot of them on Earth, too, which is a lot of fun because there's a sort of a contemporary, at least for the 70s, a contemporary element to it. So I'm going to say, as much as I did love the fourth Doctor, this third Doctor is pretty good, too. I'm going to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Next week on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about, well, nothing in wide release because there's nothing new in terms of big movies coming out next week. Way to go, Hollywood. But we'll talk about something, and until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.